Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us again today. I really do appreciate it. After a few weeks off, it's great to be doing this show again. As always, we've got a lot to talk about today, including some new heart studies, a new osteoporosis study, and we'll get some tips on how to medicine-proof our homes. But first, let's welcome a new co-host for Health Matters presented by SSM Health. It's Dr. Jennifer Wessels. Dr. Wessels is the Vice President of Medical Affairs for SSM Health Medical Group. She's also a family medicine physician. Dr. Wessels, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Fred. It's great to be here.
Every week, we'd like to go over some of the top news stories regarding health that have gone on and get your comments on them. And one of the big stories this week is a measles outbreak in a suburb of New York City. So I want you to hear about a state of emergency that went into effect overnight earlier this week in Rockland County, New York, because of the measles.
Well, my goal is to have this measles officially eradicated again in 2019.
Rockland County Executive Ed Day says he is determined to end the worst measles outbreak in the country. His emergency order went into effect at midnight, banning unvaccinated children under the age of 18 from entering public places, including schools, shopping malls, restaurants, and houses of worship. It does not apply to outdoor spaces.
Is this more of a scare tactic, or are you expecting to actually prosecute people?
We are not expecting to prosecute anybody. It is an attention grabber. I wouldn't call it a scare tactic. We're looking to get people to understand the severity of what we're facing.
Measles is highly, highly contagious.
Our Dr. John LaPook says that about 90% of people who are not vaccinated will come down with the measles if they are exposed to it.
The kicker is that people can actually be contagious for about 4 days before they come down with the rash. They can be running around spreading it to other people without even knowing they have the measles.
Dr. Wessels, how concerned are you about the measles and people not getting vaccinated?
If someone is not vaccinated, they do have a very high likelihood of contacting measles if they've been exposed. People who have measles can transmit that virus for about 9 days. So like they said in the story, 4 days before the rash appears and up to 5 days after, you can be spreading it to the community. Measles really can be a very severe illness, especially in young children, in elderly folks, and those who have compromised immune systems. It could be deadly for a lot of people.
How effective is the measles vaccine?
It is very effective. So there is a very low likelihood that you would ever get the measles if you've had both vaccinations.
Another story we heard this past week is out of the FDA. It's proposing a rule that would notify women with dense breasts about increases in cancer risks and how breast density may influence their mammogram results. Here's CBS News medical contributor Dr. David Agus.
The first time in 20 years, this regulation is being updated. And one of the big changes is now women with dense breasts, which are about half of women over the age of 40, are going to be notified that they have dense breasts. Having dense breasts is a slightly higher risk for breast cancer and also makes it much harder for mammograms to see the cancer. And so in some of these women, other forms of imaging like ultrasound or MRI may be warranted. And this will all be on now the mammography report. This is good for all women because they're going to know from this report whether they have dense breasts or not. The key is information is critical for you to make the right decision. So it really is trying to equal the bar across the country with quality of mammograms. It's a tremendous step forward.
Missouri and Illinois already have their own breast density information laws. How crucial is this for women?
Well, it's really important for women to know their risks and know their bodies. So if women are more informed that they have dense breast, they are more likely to have that conversation with their physician to ask about additional testing and to really be more fully evaluated.
As a family medicine physician, Dr. Wessels, I'm sure you've dealt with this a few times. Two large medical groups are now weighing in on kids and soda.
The American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Heart Association say it's time to add warning labels and taxes to sugary drinks and limit their marketing to kids and teens. USA Today reporting the groups would also like to see healthy drinks like milk and water dominate kids' menus and vending machines. Their joint statement highlights the health risks of excess sugar consumption among children and adolescents and notes the children of minority and low-income communities are most vulnerable. Vicky Barker, CBS News.
Dr. Wessels, what are the health risks of drinking too much soda?
Sure. So soda has huge amounts of sugar. It really puts our kids especially at risk for obesity, for diabetes, and it really increases their lifetime risk that they're going to have chronic health issues.
What's your advice to parents? How do they deal with this with their kids?
So it's best to avoid all soda altogether. If you never let your kids drink soda, then they don't request it. They don't want it. Starting healthy choices at an earlier age, drinking water, drinking milk, will really set them up for healthier outcomes for their whole life.
What about adults in soda or adults in soda and diet soda?
Sure. Well, it's really best for adults to follow the same advice that we have for kids. Drinking water, drinking milk or tea, something with no sugar content can really help. Diet sodas still pose a lot of risk to folks with the other added chemicals there are, and especially the higher levels of caffeine. So adults are just as much at risk for diabetes and obesity and other chronic health issues as children are.
I want to find out, Dr. Wessels, from you how you feel about this new report about pesticides in our produce.
The three most pesticide-contaminated fruits and vegetables are strawberry, spinach, and kale.
Kale, it's grown close to the grounds. Farmers tend to use more pesticides.
The Environmental Working Group is out with its list of produce containing the most pesticide residues. Kale, which ranked 8th last year, rose to number 3. The organization's Nika Lipa says pesticides are not a necessary evil.
Organic versions are still produced without these toxic pesticides, so we know you are able to produce fruits and vegetables without toxic pesticides.
Stephen Kaufman, CBS News.
How concerned should we be about pesticides on our produce?
So there's a lot of research that shows that there can be some health concerns, but a lot of the data is not totally conclusive just yet. We do know that washing all of our fruits and vegetables with water or dish detergent or white vinegar can really help reduce pesticides and any other germs or contaminants that may be an exposure risk for any of our produce.
Another final story I wanted to talk to you about that was in the news this week. New research adds to the evidence that getting up and moving is really good for our health.
Some say being sedentary is so bad for your health, it's the new smoking. And a new report seems to bolster that idea. The study found for those who get the least amount of physical activity, replacing a half hour of sitting time with even light physical activity was associated with a nearly 50% reduction in the chance of premature death. The review looked at sedentary and activity levels over a 14-year period. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
Is being sedentary the new smoking?
It is definitely a huge risk factor for folks, yes. So being sedentary really increases your risk of obesity. It increases your risk of diabetes and heart disease, high blood pressure. It also really decreases the strength of your muscles. So as folks get older, they're far more at risk for falls and other injuries because they're just not as strong as their counterparts who are able to exercise and be more active.
Any tips for us on how to keep moving?
Sure. So the goal really should be to keep moving or break a sweat at least once a day. Even moderate exercise as a goal about 30 minutes a day can really, really help boost your activity level. So even things like walking, climbing the stairs instead of using the elevator, even small changes like that can really make a big impact.
Dr. Wessels, thanks very much for all your expertise. Appreciate it. We'll see you again at the end of the show with a health tip for the week.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Coming up next on Health Matters, presented by SSM Health, we'll take a look at some new heart studies, including one on aspirin, which you don't want to miss. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health, on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health, on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Does taking an aspirin once a day help prevent heart attacks? Well, you may want to think again. Doctors are reversing that recommendation in the latest guidelines from the American Heart Association. Here to talk with us about that is SLU Care's Dr. Fred Buchhold. He's a general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also the new acting chief medical officer there. Dr. Buchhold, thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit more about this new study.
Well, so there's really three large studies that were published in the last year that showed, that asked the question, does taking aspirin a day prevent heart attacks or death from heart attacks? And from these three studies, the answer was in short, no. They looked at whether or not, you know, people died from heart attacks or had heart attacks if they took an aspirin a day. What kind of complicated things was based on previous studies that the patients were healthier. They, you know, they tended to smoke less. They tended to be on more medicines for blood pressure and for lowering cholesterol. Their diets were different than in previous trials. And they found that even though they did prevent some heart attacks, the risk for bleeding internally was much higher, and it kind of negated any effect there might be. And on both sides of that, both the risks and benefits, you know, there wasn't enough events to really warrant recommend doing this anymore.
So what will you tell your patients?
So, I tell them, unless they're really a high risk, not to take an aspirin for what we call primary prevention, meaning that if they've never had a heart attack or a stroke, generally, if their risk isn't very high, I would recommend not taking it anyway. Where it's changed for me is if their risk was high, but they've never had a heart attack or a stroke, I would suggest it. I think now at this point with this data, I would not suggest it, essentially, and particularly for people that are older, above the age of 70. It seems that the risks there may be much higher than the benefit of preventing a heart attack.
Are you surprised by this finding?
No, not at all. I think, again, in my world where I deal with primary prevention, and that's a big part of my work, there's often a paradox, as I like to say, is most people are too healthy to take this and to have a benefit from taking something like aspirin. And then the people that really are high risk, we're so good now of treating this disease with a number of different interventions. So treating blood pressure reasonably well, giving people lowering cholesterol medications. They've changed their diet such that it's a more heart healthy diet. And I think all those benefits are part of this kind of big pot that's mixed together to reduce the chances of heart disease. That's why it's no longer the number one leading killer. I believe it's now second behind cancer. And I think it's part of all these interventions we've had over the last 10 to 15 years.
Let's say you're a patient and you are taking an aspirin a day. What should you do?
Well, I think it depends. This is where really a nice discussion can occur with your doctor. If you take it for a long time, you presumably haven't had any side effects or risks from that. I think some people like the safety or the psychological safety of knowing that they're taking something and it may have a benefit. I would try, for most of my patients, I try to be a minimalist, so I try to take them off medicines I know don't have a clear benefit. So I think if you're on it, I would at least seriously consider stopping it. But again, that's a discussion with your own physician.
So Luke, here's Dr. Fred Buchholz, is a general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. He's also the newly named acting chief medical officer there. Joining us now on the phone is Luke Care's Dr. Michael Lim. He's a cardiologist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Lim was at that American College of Cardiology meeting in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago. He heard about an Apple Watch study there that he wanted to share. Dr. Lim, tell us about that Apple Watch study.
So this is a fascinating study in the fact that it's a completely new way to actually do medical research, where it was made available to anybody to sign up if they had an Apple Watch and they wanted to download an app on their iPhone. And so in a very, very, very quick amount of time, 400,000 people signed up to participate in this study that would utilize the watch technology to see if that were a good use to detect abnormal heart rhythms, especially atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation in itself can be a big-time problem. It is the most common heart rhythm problem that we see in medicine, and it can be a big-time problem because if you have it, it can increase your risk for having a stroke. And so certainly we'd like to do anything possible to prevent that stroke before it happens. And the heart watch is a really interesting concept, or the Apple Watch. Is a really interesting concept in that it actually can determine your heart rate and it can determine the irregularity of that rate and thus potentially atrial fibrillation. The study reviews in terms of what it found were a little bit mixed. It was able to detect atrial fibrillation, but it also had some what we would call false positive alarms, meaning the Apple Watch would give an alarm to the person wearing it saying, hey, you may be having atrial fibrillation. You could contact the physician or the study center And sometimes that didn't hold true to be the case. But in other ways, it actually did detect atrial fibrillation that was asymptomatic, meaning the person who ended up having atrial fibrillation would have not known it in any other way. And so I think the second take-home point for this is not only is this a unique study designed to get 400,000 people to participate in trying to improve heart care, but these wearable technologies that that consumers can have, like the Apple Watch and other things that we wear, have the ability to impact our health. And we're just scratching the surface on being able to really take advantage of this technology.
What other sort of wearable technology is out there that you think is worth thinking about?
Well, I think there's multiple different things that can track not only your heart rate, but number of steps that you walk on a daily basis, the number of stairs you climb, how much physical activity you get. These are things like the Fitbit or the Garmin or other devices like that. These are really interesting things to kind of keep track of. Well, how active am I? And as they also record your heart rate, you know, I think that they fall into the same category as the Apple Watch, as they may be kind of helpful as a screening type tool. Several of my colleagues have gotten contacted by patients saying, hey, I've noticed that on my watch or on my Fitbit, my heart rate's awful fast, and I'm unsure about that. So these are things where people now are more aware of how many steps they walk, how many miles that they travel on a daily basis, and what their heart rates are, and whether they're keeping on track with being active enough and contributing to their own health, or maybe they've fallen off track and they have a way of tracking or monitoring how they get back into it.
We're talking with SLU Care cardiologist Dr. Michael Lim at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Lim, another study at that American College of Cardiology meeting in New Orleans took a look at how to treat patients with aortic stenosis. What's aortic stenosis?
The aortic valve is the last valve in your heart. It's the exit valve where all blood leaving your heart going to the body has to go through. And it turns out that that valve wears out later in life. And when that wears out, we only used to have surgical aortic valve replacement to treat that condition. And many patients who couldn't undergo surgery didn't have any other better treatment until over the past decade, we've developed transcatheter aortic valve replacement technologies where you can replace that valve without open heart surgery by a catheter type or minimally invasive procedure. And this has been a phenomenal change in cardiovascular medicine. And in fact, in my opinion, this is the biggest change in the practice of heart care and cardiology over the past 15 years. And the studies actually advanced this frontier into patients who would be otherwise deemed to be low risk for having a surgical aortic valve replacement. So it was really challenging the catheter valves and saying, are they actually as good or better than surgery? And it turns out that that answer was a strongly definitive yes. And so this is great options for patients with aortic valve stenosis that now that more and more people are going to have choices. They can have their valve replaced by a catheter and have their valve replaced by a surgery. The only caveat to that is that the FDA and the payment bodies have not endorsed the low-risk patient to have their aortic valve replaced by catheter yet, but I would fully expect the strength of the data based on the studies will be presented to the FDA and Medicare and other governing bodies, and these things will happen relatively quickly throughout the course of 2019. So patients will have greater options for being able to replace the aortic valve. They won't have to choose between just one option, surgery is my only choice. They will get the chance between a catheter valve replacement and surgical valve replacement. Anytime you have a choice, it's a lot better when you're a patient.
Dr. Lim, thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Fred. Take care.
Coming up, when you think about osteoporosis, do you always picture an older woman? Well, a recent study shed some new light on that topic. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A new study finds older men receive less treatment for osteoporosis than women of the same age. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Gregory Nelson. He's an orthopedic surgeon at SSM Health DePaul Hospital. Dr. Nelson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me about this new study about osteoporosis and men.
Yes, this is very interesting. This study was done in the VA system in Puget Sound, and they looked at 13,000 men and women. They focused on men and women who were at a higher risk of developing a typical osteoporotic fracture, such as a hip fracture. And what they found was that older men who are at an increased risk of osteoporotic fracture are not being screened or treated for their osteoporosis at rates comparable to women. One of the findings in the study was that women were five times more likely than men to undergo, say, a DEXA scan, which is a type of test to look at bone density.
Were you surprised by this finding?
You know, I was not. I think that the medical community has known for a while that osteoporosis occurs in men, but is often not on in the forefront of providers' minds, that it can be overlooked, or that the burden of treating these patients is being neglected in certain ways. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that men present differently with their osteoporosis. They typically present about 10 years later in life because men have higher peak bone density when they're young, and so it takes longer for their bone density to decrease to a level that puts them at risk for these osteoporotic fractures or these broken bone injuries. They also tend to have different causes for their osteoporosis. Those can be secondary to medications that they're taking or to hormonal changes that tend to happen later in life. And so, obviously, on the street, you know, the average person thinks about little old lady or thinks about grandma when they think about hip fractures, but not everyone is thinking about men, and unfortunately not all physicians aren't necessarily thinking about it the way we ought to be.
How important is it to get an early diagnosis for osteoporosis?
It's definitely important. I think it's important for men and women. I think that the main reason for getting an early diagnosis is because you can begin the treatment. Many of the treatments that we have today are primarily directed at slowing the loss of bone density with time and therefore maintaining the strength of the bone that we have. And so you can imagine if you're diagnosed early, then you can maintain that health of the bone or that strength of the bone better. If you're diagnosed late and the bones are already quite brittle, there are fewer options that we have to try to reverse the process and actually make the bones stronger than at the time of diagnosis.
It seems to me a lot of people that are dealing with osteoporosis or trying to prevent it take a calcium pill or vitamin D supplements. Is that enough?
No, it probably isn't enough. There's some more recent data that is showing that simply intervening with vitamin D supplementation and calcium either through diet or with supplementation probably isn't enough to really turn the tide in this matter. Unfortunately, you know, we're fighting against biology, and our biology starts to wear out as we get older. We think that there is some promise in this field because there are a few medications that are available these days which can actually build bone and increase bone density. But unfortunately, as in everything in life, even in medicine, nothing comes without a cost. So some of those medications can have some serious side effects, and not every patient is a great candidate for it. So really, again, very important to try to maintain bone health throughout our lives and be diagnosed early so we can prevent the rapid loss.
We're talking with Dr. Gregory Nelson. He's an orthopedic surgeon at SSM Health DePaul Hospital. Tell us about some of the warning signs for osteoporosis.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, unfortunately, osteoporosis is a pretty silent disease. Most people don't notice that they have it. Their only real hunch is that they've got a family history of osteoporosis. Patients aren't going to start to notice things like, say, bone-related pain or a sudden sense of weakness. And so it's much more an issue of having a high suspicion for this, recognizing who is at risk. And, you know, for patients to advocate for themselves and say to their primary care doctor, hey, doc, you know, should I be checked for this? I know that this is not something that will necessarily present with symptoms. How can we get ahead of this problem?
Are there blood tests, that sort of thing, that can be done?
There are some blood tests. So the blood tests don't specifically identify osteoporosis. They can help to determine what was the cause, the underlying cause of a patient's osteoporosis. The main test that's used is this test I mentioned before called a DEXA scan. It's basically like a special X-ray that measures the amount of X-ray beam that passes through the bone. As you can imagine, the harder, denser bone will prevent X-ray beams from passing through, and that can be correlated to the density of the bone. There is one thing that's important to remember here, though. As an orthopedic surgeon, my basic concern is not primarily to prevent osteoporosis, but to prevent fractures. And it's important for patients to recognize that you can have osteopenia, which is a condition that sort of is a precursor to osteoporosis, and you can still be at risk for higher fracture. So even if the doctor says your bone density is okay, it doesn't mean that you're not at risk for falling down and breaking a bone. And so there are other things that we would want you to know about and to try to pursue in that sense. Things like in that category would be, avoiding exposure to nicotine and excessive alcohol intake, getting enough sunlight, increasing your weight-bearing exercise. You know, the bone is really smart and responds to forces. And so when you stand on your bone, walk on your bone, run on the bone strengthens itself. And so those things are really important lifestyle changes that every patient can try to make that can help to prevent the onset of osteoporosis and the event of a future fracture.
What about balance training? How important is that?
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that. There's some more recent data that looks at a condition called sarcopenia. Sarcopenia sounds kind of like osteopenia, and it's related. The idea is that as we get older, not only do our bones get weaker, but our muscles actually get weaker. And so we can do balance training and other kinds of exercises, and we can actually maintain our bone mass. We can maintain all the parts of our nervous system that help us to maintain our balance. And if we can prevent falls, we can definitely prevent fractures.
Dr. Nelson, you talked about the lack of awareness in the medical community. What are you trying to do there to raise that awareness?
Yeah, great. We've been looking at some of this data over quite a period of time, and what we've decided to do here at SSM DePaul Hospital is convene a group of physicians across multiple disciplines. That would be primary care, orthopedic surgery, rheumatology, endocrinology, and put our heads together to try to develop a systematic approach to identifying patients, screening patients, and making sure that we get them connected with the appropriate intervention that can help them. So we are hoping that in the next several months we'll be able to roll that out for patients and have our own bone health clinic program.
Dr. Nelson, thanks a lot for your time. Really do appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Dr. Gregory Nelson is an orthopedic surgeon at SSM Health DePaul Hospital. Coming up, most parents know to store medicine safely, yet every 10 minutes a child goes to the ER for medicine poisoning. We'll find out more about that as we continue Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Every day, 142 children under age 6 are being seen at the emergency room after getting into medicine. That's one child every 10 minutes. We recently observed National Poison Prevention Awareness Week, and here to talk with us about that is Julie Weber. She's the director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Julie, what do we need to know?
Well, what's really important to know is that we're bringing out awareness of poisons and the risk of poisonings in the home for children as well as adults. And it's a way to bring out awareness and so people know that they need to have the 1-800-222-1222 number programmed into their cell phones for any type of poisoning or drug information question.
What are some of the most common poisonings?
One of the most common poisonings that we see overall in all age groups is acetaminophen, and that's the generic name for Tylenol or pain medications. That really seems to be something that children get into because often it's in their access and it has a good taste, or adults misdose on it or take too much of it.
What other things are up there?
Up there, too, are cleaning products. Different household products such as cleaners, such as bleach, Windex, different things that we leave out as we're cleaning and using it in our home is very accessible and available to children. And that age range is really like the 2 to 3 year old is one of our most common ages. And so with these products out and available, they're very intrigued by them and get into them.
We'll get some prevention tips from you in a minute. But first, let's talk about what should you do if you think your child has ingested a type of poison.
What we say to do immediately is, of course, if they're coughing or choking, you want to wipe out their mouth, but to immediately call. We don't want people going to the internet to look up the product or ingredients. Just bring that container to the phone, make that call, and then one of our registered pharmacists or nurses who are specially trained can help answer the question.
What sort of advice do they give at the Missouri Poison Center? Do you always have to bring your child in?
That's what's great about calling the Poison Center is no, we try to keep everybody at home if it's a possibility and safe for that child or adult. So we really go through asking many questions about the product, about what happened, age, weight sometimes, and then we can help triage or manage them at home. So we decide if it's a problem, and if it's something that we just expect maybe a minor symptom, we can give some home treatment advice. And then what a lot of people don't know is that we call back. So we call back to make sure everything's okay.
Remind us of the number again.
1-800-222-1222.
We're talking with Julie Weber. She's the director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Julie, let's go over some prevention tips. What things should parents do around the home?
Our number one thing is with any type of potential poisons, we really want them up high and, if possible, in a locked cabinet. The best thing, though, is to keep them out of sight because then the child isn't even enticed by them or want to get into them. So up high, locked cabinets with medications, make sure that child-resistant cap is on, and to always leave things in the original bottle with the original labels.
If a pill bottle has the words child-resistant cap on it, do you assume it's child-resistant?
I never do because it's there to slow them down, but it doesn't 100% keep them out. So it is a method to help with prevention and has helped prevent some exposures, but children still can manipulate those lids and get them off.
I know a lot of parents probably lock their medicine up or store it safely, but the more frequent medicines, the medicines they take every night, they may be a little less guarded about, correct?
Correct. What we see happen is often parents will leave, like especially if a child's sick, they'll leave that medicine out because they know they're going to have to get up in the middle of the night to redose that medication. And sometimes, especially with the liquid medicines, they kind of get gummy around the top, and so that lid doesn't close tightly, and children still can easily then get into them and often wake up before a parent and find that and think it tastes good and get into it. So even if it is a daily use medicine or a medicine we're using for some type of sickness, they still need to be put up and out of their sight.
Probably not a good idea to try and get a child to take his or her pill by saying it's candy, right?
Right. I don't know if you've ever seen our lookalikes, but on our website, we have lookalike pictures of different candies and medicine. I think always which comes to my mind first are Red Hots, look just like Sudafed, a decongestant tablet. And really, when we say it's candy, it's giving the child the wrong message, and we don't want them to think that it's good. It's something to help them, but not a treat.
Is it a good idea maybe to go around the house at the child's level and try to see what's out there from a child's perspective?
It really is. It's kind of fun to do even with your child. If you have one that's 3 or 4 years old, and you can go on a poison hunt like a safari, and you crawl around on the floor with them and looking on to find the different poisons so you can get them up and out of their sight.
Let's go back to the household chemical problem. Tell us about that.
With household chemicals, what we see frequently happen is that people will want to take that chemical out of its original container and put that into like something we use for eating or drinking. Sometimes we'll have that they'll put like a fertilizer. It looks blue like Kool-Aid, and they'll mix it up in a pitcher and then you actually even use a glass to pour it into the plants. that is really a mixed message, and it's really a poisoning waiting to happen. We really need to never store any type of potential poisoning in any kind of container that we use, like a soda bottle, a water bottle, milk jug. Leave, again, that original label on there and in the original container.
We're talking with Julie Weber from the Missouri Poison Center. Any other internet challenges out there that you're seeing a lot of activity with parents calling you saying, oh no, my child has tried this?
Fortunately, we haven't had any new type of resurgence of any type of challenges. I think we have really educated and got the message out there about the laundry pods and how we can't be doing that in a challenge. And I think for the moment, it's really slowed down a little bit.
What's the most common call these days?
The most common call that I've been seeing these days has really been on pain medications. In children still, though, we still see a lot of cleaning substances, especially with spring coming. So it's those different polishes and waxes out there. And then environmental-wise, with outside, it's March, and really what we're going to start seeing with spring is the waking up of snakes. So we really say caution to outside and around the house. When you get those leaf piles from the winter kind of raked out so there's no habitats for the snakes, and really kind of keep an eye out for them.
Julie, before we let you go, run by us once again some of the most important things you think parents need to know.
Some of the most important things. Number one is to know the Poison Center number at 1-800-222-1222. And the other most important item is never to wait. Just immediately call. The call is free, totally confidential, and you're speaking with a specially trained nurse or pharmacist who can answer that question usually within 3 minutes. So don't waste that time to go on the internet or call around and ask friends. Make that call. It can be life-saving.
24/7?
24/7 every day of the week and month and year.
Julie, thanks a lot for your time. Really do appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for giving me a call. I appreciate it, too.
Julie Weber is the director of the Missouri Poison Center at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Thanks again, Julie.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We're back with our co-host, Dr. Jennifer Wessels. She's the VP of Medical Affairs for SSM Health Medical Group. Dr. Wessels, what's your health tip for the week?
Well, Fred, now that it's getting a little bit warmer and sunnier out, we really wanted to talk about getting enough vitamin D. So when folks are able to go outside and get a little bit of sunshine, your body is able to use that and create vitamin D. Vitamin D is really protective, not just for our bones to help absorb calcium, but also really helps support our immune system and help decrease inflammation in the body.
Dr. Wessels, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You can follow me on Twitter at Fred Bottomer KMOX. And if you miss any part of the show, you can download the podcast at KMOX.com. Please join us again next time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.